two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Voices of Reason. This is Amy Donaldson. I'm flying solo this week. I have no Jason Lee. He's still in Ghana. I'm joined this week by a very good friend of ours, Congressman Ben McAdams. We produce here at Loudmouth Project, we produce his podcast, Washingtown. But we wanted to have a little bit broader conversation than you normally. You usually do the interviewing on your podcast. But wanted to talk about a bill that you're working on that is, I think, interesting but also complicated. Why don't you give us a little bit of background?
So I'm going to start by telling you a story. Charles Kokesh owned a firm that provided investment advice to business development companies. So over the course of about 12 years, Charles Kokesh misappropriated tens of millions of dollars from the companies that he was advising, funding a lavish lifestyle for himself, just, you know, living high and siphoning money off from this company, from these companies who he was hired to invest in or provide advice to. And in the process then was defrauding the investors out of millions of dollars. So after his illegal activity was discovered by the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they brought an enforcement action against Mr. Kokesh. He was found guilty of misappropriating these investor funds, and the court ordered him to pay a civil penalty of $2.4 million. And they also ordered him to give back roughly $35 million that he had taken. This is in the law, it's called, you have equitable remedies and punitive penalties. So, and punitive means essentially that you're punished. Here's your punishment for the crime. And then equitable is fairness. Well, you also, there's a punishment. There's a fine for your bad actions, but you also have to give back the money you stole, which isn't necessarily a punishment. It's just making whole the people who you did harm to. So in 2017, the Supreme Court ruled that the Securities and Exchange Commission's disgorgement authority, that's the ability of them to seek repayment of their ill-gotten gains, that it's subject to a 5-year statute of limitations. And they hinted that the Supreme Court also hinted in a footnote that the SEC might not even be able to seek disgorgement at all. So what did that mean for Charles Kokesh? Well, in the end, he was ordered to repay $5 million in his profits and got to keep another $30 million for himself. $30 million that he was able to get through nefarious means. That's $30 million in profits from illegal activity. And most importantly, it's $30 million that those people who were defrauded by him will never get back. So what does the Supreme Court decision mean for the SEC? Well, they estimate that in the 2 years since the Kokesh decision, it didn't just apply to Charles Kokesh. It now applies to all enforcement actions that the SEC is bringing. So the SEC estimates that in the 2 years since this decision, they have had to forego over $1 billion in disgorged funds. That's $1 billion in illegally gained funds that people get to keep rather than return to the investors that they took it from.
Can I ask what the rationale of the court was?
Well, the rationale is, so again, it's under the law, you have kind of these two remedies. One is punitive.
Mm-hmm.
I have four kids, so let's analogize it to my kids. My kids break a light, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have two, and they're recklessly, they're paying, and they break the light fixture. So on one hand, I'm going to punish them. I'm going to say, you cannot, this ball is going to be in timeout for a week.
Yeah.
And then I also might have another remedy, which is you also have to pay $20 to fix the light fixture. Now, that's not necessarily a punishment. That is just out of fairness.
Restitution.
You broke it.
Yeah.
You have to fix it, right? So there's these two courses of remedies under the law. Well, the Supreme Court ruled that this disgorgement, having to give back these funds, looks a lot more like punishment than it does fairness. And so punishment is always subject to a statute of limitations. Actions of fairness, restoring the funds you took, has historically, it's not subject to a statute of limitations. You just have to give back the money you made. You have to pay restitution for whatever you did. And then a punishment on top of that is subject to the statute of limitations. They ruled that it all looks like punishment. I think it was a wrong decision. And the impact of the decision is what we're telling all these fraudsters is if you can hold on for 5 years, you're golden. Yeah, you know, the rest of it, you get to keep everything after 5 years. And so it really has some pretty negative impacts on the SEC's ability to enforce on, I guess a fraudster has every incentive to hide it already, but gives them a greater benefit for being able to conceal their behavior. And the investors just lose, you know, they don't get this money back. Even if the person who stole it has it still, they don't have to give it back if it's beyond the 5 year window.
And on the 5 year window, is it does the clock start running the minute they get charged, or is it from the time it occurs? Like, because you can delay something 5 years in the courts pretty easily.
Yeah. Well, it'd be a rolling window. So from the time the action is brought, it would freeze it there. But if Charles Kokesh was defrauding people for 12 years, once they brought the action, it would start. That would be the time. They'd be able to go back 5 years from that time. So he essentially gets to keep 7 years of his illegal activity, and he'd be subject to disgorgement for the most recent 5 years. So you're not rewarded for the delay in the courts, but you are rewarded if you're not caught or if it's not brought for a certain period
of time.
This
seems stunning because if you look at like seizure laws, like they're, you know, the civil forfeiture laws, it's like the opposite. They don't care at all. You don't even have to get convicted and you can lose property.
Yeah.
So is this just that it's the SEC or is it the white collar versus... I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Or they challenged it in the Supreme Court.
They challenged it in the Supreme Court. Yeah. They made a winning argument that the Supreme Court upheld. And essentially, the remedy is the Supreme Court saying, now, Congress can set the laws. We can say statute of limitations for this isn't 5 years. It's forever, you know, or whatever we want to say. And so that's where we are right now is the Supreme Court handed down this decision in 2017 that everybody recognizes is a bad decision.
It created a bunch of problems.
Yeah, the Supreme Court would say it's a good decision, but it does create, it recognizes that it does create this problem of, and so it warrants a reaction from Congress. Are we satisfied with the 5 year statute of limitations or do we want to change that? So that's where my legislation comes in.
And when we come back, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about exactly what the legislation does and sort of how you got involved in it.
Great.
You're listening to the Voices of Reason. A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to the Voices of Reason. This is Amy Donaldson, flying solo this week, here with Congressman Ben McAdams in his very austere West Jordan office. thanks for taking some time to talk about this legislation that deals with some financial fraud issues that were raised by Supreme Court decision in 2017. So why don't you just give us some background on how you got involved in this?
Yeah. So one of the things people don't know about me is prior to serving as the mayor of Salt Lake County and in the Utah State Senate, I'm a securities attorney. And so this is the area of law that I practiced in. I taught at the University of Utah Law School securities regulation. So this is a subject matter that I have some expertise and some passion, really. And so when I was elected to the state Senate in 2009, one of the issues that I wanted to focus on was financial fraud. And Utah, you know, we are one of the leading states in the nation for financial fraud. And I did some calculations at the time that working with some of our law enforcement agencies here that and we estimated the value of fraud per year in the state of Utah. And I was surprised to learn that that fraud in Utah is larger than the ski industry in Utah in the amount of dollars that are siphoned off from hardworking people going to for ill-gotten gains. And so for me, it became personal. These mm-hmm. are this is my state, and you know people ask why.
Would you just go into that a little bit? Because I think sometimes people think people who do this white collar crime, like these are people with money stealing from people who have money. Why should I care about that?
Yeah. Well. For me, I would say it's personal. One of the things that I love about living in Utah, everybody comes here and says, people are so nice. People are so friendly. And that is true. That's why, you know, I was born and raised here. My wife was born and raised here. But we moved out of state for a few years and we wanted to move back to raise our kids here because Utah is so nice and friendly and family friendly. It's a great place to live. And yet I think that that's also what people prey upon. These are people who take advantage of our best qualities. We are so quick to trust and so willing to see the best in others. And they use that to prey upon us, to gain our trust. And many of the people who are who I've met who are victims of fraud, it's the sweet widow whose husband just passed away and she's looking to stretch out her retirement savings so that she can stretch it through her golden years. And she hears somebody who comes, you know, bearing promises that of financial success and we can help you and you'll be able to provide for your grandkids and do all these things and convinces this person to then invest. And it strings along for a little while. And these are real life stories that I've heard that they then say, well, you know, what's happening with my investment? Don't worry. It's, here's the status of it. It's actually growing. It's going really well. All the while, this person is driving fancy cars, flying around on a private jet, building an enormous home with these illegally taken funds. And it all comes crashing down usually about 10 years later when they can't sustain, they can't bring in enough victims to sustain the lifestyle. And, they'll take an investment of $1 million and they'll pay back $100,000. And that person thinks that they're reaping some benefit on it. And they're really good about stringing along. And when we see these headlines in the state of Utah, every few months, sadly.
Yeah.
And the victims are real people. They're people we go to church with, that we work with, that we're our neighbors who are just trying to live their lives and doing what we love about Utah. They're trusting and mm-hmm. friendly and seeing the best in others, and they're preying upon that.
And one of the things I remember, a victim of a pretty heinous crime had gotten a settlement, a life insurance settlement, and it became a big news story because they got taken advantage of and stolen from. Right. And I think that, those are the cases where you think, but there's so much, like they don't go get help or they don't report it because there's a bit of shame associated with this idea that I trusted them and they'll say, well, didn't you get a statement or didn't you do this or didn't you do that? And you just feel worse, right, about it. And in my experience, they don't usually get the money back. It's gone.
It's gone. Sophisticated, savvy people fall for this all the time. You know, it's a friend, it's someone you trust, and you don't ask for the disclosures and all of that. And then you feel stupid and you feel taken advantage of, and you don't want to admit it, so you're slow to go to the authorities. And so when I was in the state Senate, I introduced several pieces of legislation to try and tackle this. We were able to pass those pieces of legislation with bipartisan support through the Utah State Senate. It became an issue that I felt really strongly about. And being part of cracking down on some of these investment scams in Utah, something that I'm very proud of my service in the state Senate. As mayor, my life took a different direction. You know, I was more focused on potholes and cutting grass in parks and building trails than anything else. But it is something where I think that I don't want Utah to change. I don't want us to be less trusting and less willing to see the good in others and to see the best in a stranger. I want the strangers who are trying to change us or take advantage of us to face the consequences and that we can recover the maximum amount from those people who are preying upon us.
So then did you know about this Supreme Court case and decide to address it, or did somebody bring it to you?
I was aware of the case. And as were many people, it's been about 2 years since that case was handed down. There was concern from the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC had expressed that this would really hinder their ability to enforce against bad actors. Republicans and Democrats knew that this was something we'd have to address. There's some senators who are looking at it on the Senate side. And so I'm on the House today. I'm on the House Financial Services Committee that has oversight over the Securities and Exchange Commission and the laws in this area. And so in talking with some of my colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats, we've said we've got to take action on this, and we've got to pass legislation to restore the SEC's ability to recover these ill-gotten funds from fraudsters who were taking advantage of people across this country, and to make sure that we can recover those funds to the greatest extent possible. And so I partnered up with Representative Hazenga, Republican, to work on, and we've introduced legislation. There was, we had a hearing in June where the SEC came and testified about, and other experts testified about this legislation and what would, why it would be necessary, and maybe some parameters of what it would look like. And then we went to work from there to really hammer out the details. You know, there, we all agreed that legislation was necessary, what that legislation looked like. There were some differences of opinion in that regard. So rolled up my sleeves, Representative Hazenga and I and our staffs got together, worked with the SEC and others to kind of craft what a good piece of legislation would look like to address this. So in September, we had a hearing, a committee hearing on this, and we're able to pass out this legislation out of committee with strong bipartisan support.
I'm wondering who would be against something like this.
Well, you know, some...
You know, maybe they're against the details. I don't know.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, some of the investment community is concerned because... before Kokesh, you would have to disgorge all the funds. And people would say, you know, that is hard for us to quantify if we are a business and maybe one of our employees is committing fraud and we don't know that. And do we have to reserve against this? What will it do to our business? I hear that concern. I disagree with that concern. If one of your employees has defrauded people, then you should be responsible to pay people back. But that was some of the concern of maybe they didn't know to what extent should they be responsible for the actions of one of their employees.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about what's in the bill and sort of what it's like to kind of take the little bits and pieces that everybody tells you, their expertise, and put them into a bill. You're listening to the Voices of Reason podcast. Welcome back to the Voices of Reason. This is Amy Donaldson. I'm by myself this week, all by myself, driving this car. And this week I'm joined by Congressman Ben McAdams. We are discussing fraud and what this bill, what's the actual title of this bill? It has a long title.
It does have a long title. I'm not sure. Shareholder Protection.
But basically addresses fraud. People who are defrauded by...
Investor protection.
Yeah. So let's just start that over.
Okay. What's the bill called?
Investor Protection and Capital Markets Fairness Act.
Okay.
I remember.
Let's start over.
Like,
I know.
Yeah. I won't ask that question.
Okay.
Okay, Josh. As soon as I said it, I was like, that was a dumb question, but, you know, I'm a sports writer. And this week I'm joined by Congressman Ben McAdams. We are discussing fraud and what we're talking about fraud. And it's a topic that unfortunately is all too familiar here in Utah. But you've taken some action on the federal level. And I just wondered, as you were describing in the last segment, sort of the negotiations and having the SEC come in and testify, what goes into putting this together? Like, it seems to me that everyone should want to eliminate fraud and hold fraudsters accountable and make them pay stuff back. So what are the points of contention?
Yeah, I mean, so before the Kokesh decision, the statute of limitations for the punishment part was 5 years, but the statute of limitations for the disgorgement, the equitable remedy, was to whatever amount. There's no limit on time. And we wanted to, my original version of the bill would restore it back to the disgorgement, which was subject to the full dollar amount that you had defrauded, not subject to a limit of time. Now, there was some, as we discussed on the last segment, there were a few people who said that they wanted it to not be infinite in time, but limited in time. And the Kokesh decision by the Supreme Court limited it to 5 years. And most people agreed that that was too short. And so we were talking about what kind of time limit was appropriate. And, you know, for me, this gets into the art of legislation that I brought my best idea to the table. And I can stick with that, and I can stand on my soapbox and say why. And I will say to this day, I think it is only fair for people to give back every penny that they may have taken. If they're found guilty of fraud, they should give back every penny. And it doesn't matter what the statute of limitations is. But the reality was that legislation was never going to pass out of committee, with especially not with bipartisan support. So I could have the perfect version of the bill as I saw it and really have nothing, or I could compromise. I could work with people who had different points of view that were valid points of view, and I could try and find common ground with them and pass a bill out of committee with strong bipartisan support that would pass, have a good chance of passing the House of Representatives, and hopefully find fertile ground in the Senate that we could get something to the president's desk that would be signed, because there are people out there right now, as I mentioned earlier, the Securities and Exchange Commission estimates that in the last 2 years, they have lost $1 billion that they have not been able to recover from fraudsters because of this. And so that's $1 billion in 2 years. So every delay, every partisanship or disagreement or inability to compromise means grandma who lost her retirement is never going to get it back because I'm not willing to compromise with somebody on the other side of the aisle. And I think that's wrong. So the art of legislation is sitting down and talking with people who have different points of view and finding common ground that can move you forward.
Were there any aspects of it? I mean, because obviously you felt like legislation was necessary to refine the Supreme Court. That couldn't stand.
Right.
So were there any aspects that you said, I have to have this aspect to it?
Well, I'll give you really the negotiation was around how long the statute of limitations would be, from infinite just based on the dollar amount to 5 years was the other extreme, that it would be cut off at 5 years. What we ultimately settled on was a 14-year statute of limitations for disgorgement of ill-gotten funds. I think, 14 years is pretty
Which
good. You're
going to
capture most of it.
Yeah, because one of the things you said that rung true for me, that in my experience years ago in the news division, was that it takes a while to figure out that somebody's stealing from you, right? Or that or that this investment may not be legitimate. And sometimes that can be 5, 6, 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And so the 5-year thing seemed like you might not even know, or you might not know the fullness of it. In that short amount of time.
So in the example of Charles Kokesh, the person whose case went to the Supreme Court, it was 12 years. And so a 5-year statute of limitations would mean that he's keeping 65% of the money he stole. He gets to just pocket and walk away with for free. And I just think that's wrong. But a 14-year statute of limitations would pick up 100% of his illegal activity. It'd pick up most of them. You might have some where a year or two is lopped off at the end. I think that would be unfortunate. But in the interest of getting legislation that can pass with bipartisan support and hopefully get to the president's desk, I think it's a respectable compromise.
So it passed out of committee, and how difficult was that?
So by the time we got consensus, it was pretty strong consensus. I made my presentation to the committee. My co-sponsor, Republican Hazanga, made a presentation in support of the legislation. Another member ran amendment to it to try to change the statute of limitations from 14 years to 6 years, and I spoke against that. As did Representative Hazanga. I believe, and it was debated, and that amendment to shorten the statute, everybody agreed that something needed to happen. It was, again, a debate about the length of the statute of limitations. That amendment to change it to 6 years got some votes, I want to say 10 to 15 votes in support. It's a committee of over 60 people, so it wasn't close to passing, but it was a healthy debate, healthy discussion. The amendment failed, and then the bill itself came up for a vote out of committee. And it passed with strong bipartisan support. In fact, many of the people who voted in support of the amendment to shorten the statute of limitations, ultimately voted for the 14-year statute of limitations. I think they all agreed it was a respectable compromise and worth advancing it to the House for a full House vote.
And so did it. Where does it go next?
Now it's waiting action on the House floor. We're hearing positive signals that seems like the support is still there. So hopefully it'll come up for action on the House floor in the next few months. And we feel really good about it. And then there is a similar piece of legislation on the Senate side that they're trying to address the same decision. It's not a mirror identical to my bill, but I think it's close. And then we'll see what action comes out of the Senate, and we'll try and negotiate a compromise and move something forward.
Is that bill on the Senate side, somewhere in the same universe? Like, could they come together or in?
Yeah, probably they'd come together in some type of a conference committee, and we'd hammer out the differences between the two pieces of legislation, and then send the revised version back to both the House and the Senate with the expectation that it'd pass at that point.
So in a perfect world, when do you expect something like this might, you know, go to the Senate, or the Senate bill come to you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can't really control the Senate timeline. So I'm hoping that we can have something out of the House with a strong bipartisan vote. You know, if we can pass it out of the House with strong votes on both sides of the aisle, that sends a signal to the Senate as well that Republicans and Democrats in the House have come together and we want to see action on this. So
do you go ahead and go to the Senate and say, hey, and try to gather some support?
Yeah, I mean, those conversations happen and are happening. And the Senate will probably kind of take their own course, but hopefully with a strong bipartisan support, we can drive the expediency on the Senate side, that they'll feel some urgency, that there is support. This isn't controversial. There's support to take some action, and we can get something done.
So we're going to come back in just a minute, and when we do, we're going to talk about why the bipartisan aspect of it is so important. You're listening to the Voices of Reason. Welcome back to the Voices of Reason. This is Amy Donaldson. I am flying without a co-host this week, as my Jason's one more week in Ghana. He'll be back next week. Joined this week by Congressman Ben McAdams. We've been discussing a piece of legislation that you've been pushing that would basically reform or reinstate some of the protections for consumers when it comes to fraud, people who are defrauded by securities and investments, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that's the very, very lay person synopsis of that bill. So why does bipartisanship matter? Like you said, the Senate will see it come out with a lot of bipartisan support. Who cares? Why does that matter?
Well, and I think we can talk about both my legislation, but then legislation generally, right? So I probably had the votes to pass it out on day one with only Democratic votes. Mm-hmm. But for me, I knew that the bill really wouldn't probably go anywhere with just Democratic votes. What I wanted to do was to change the law, because I think that the law as it stands right now, people are losing out. They're not able to recover money lost in fraud from fraudsters. And so it's important to me to not just have a symbolic vote, but to actually make a difference and to get something done. And so the art of legislation is, a lot of times it's the smoke signals you're sending up. And the smoke signal I wanted to send up is, this passed out of committee, not on a party line vote. Because if it's passed on party line vote, that kind of sends the signal to the House floor. They're going to look and see how it was addressed in committee. And so a party line vote in committee probably leads to a party line vote on the House floor. A party line vote on the House floor probably means that the Senate's just going to ignore it as a message bill or something symbolic that we did. And I think we can do better than that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, by sitting down and talking to somebody on the other side of the aisle, by working really hard to get bipartisan support, the smoke signal we send out of committee as it goes to the House floor is there's a lot of consensus around this. This is a good bill, and it's not really a Republican-Democrat bill. It's a good bill. That's good for the American people. We send that signal to the House floor, and hopefully we get a strong bipartisan vote on the House floor that then sends that same signal to the Senate, that this is something that is desired and needed and not really that controversial. All the details have been hammered out. You guys should take it up too.
There's two reactions I have. One is that just being here in Salt Lake and reading the things I read and listening to things I listen to, it's our impression that not a lot is getting done in Washington. And some of that happens because the Senate won't take up what the House does, and the House won't take up what the Senate does. So how do you – like, what's the response to that? Is it possible for this to be taken up by the Senate? I mean, are you hopeful that –
Yeah, I think sometimes you get a misperception. So, and I don't want this by any means to be blaming the news media, especially sitting across from Amy Donaldson here.
That's right. Be careful.
The news
is going to
cover.
Control your mic.
The news is going to cover what's newsworthy.
Yeah.
Consensus and isn't really
and
newsworthy.
Cooperation
isn't newsworthy.
It's not super sexy headline.
Yeah. This bill, we've hammered out all of the controversy, which is why it's ready to pass. It also is why it probably isn't hugely newsworthy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because all the controversy is hammered out before it comes up for a vote. So Washington, they're actually, I think Washington is low on results, and I'm frustrated by the gridlock and partisanship there. But there is stuff that gets done, and it just doesn't drive the headlines because it's just not as interesting. Mm-hmm. What is going to be interesting is where there are epic battles and disagreement, and that's naturally going to get covered. It's naturally what people are going to pay attention to. It's what you remember. And so there's a lot of controversy.
Maybe you and Representative Huzinga could fake a fight. See?
Fighting about statute of limitations. That's classic statute of limitations argument.
No, I do think there is this also a reluctance to give the other team a win.
There is. Uh-huh.
So how is it possible that everyone – I mean, this seems to me to be – really difficult to find a reason that you would be against this.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah, no,
so,
I agree.
So how do you couch it, or how do you sell it to everyone that, like, this is everyone is doing the right thing for the right reasons? And like you say, billions of dollars are being kept by thieves that would maybe be eligible to be returned to the people who were victims.
Well, it would be a travesty for it not to be voted out just based on politics. You know, I won a very close election, and there are people who don't want to see me have any success because if I'm successful, it might be a reason to reelect me. Mm-hmm. And that would be a travesty if we look past the millions of people, thousands of people who are defrauded every year and not able to recover, and we don't fix that, even where we've got bipartisan consensus, if we don't fix that because of partisanship. I think there are people with partisan leanings like that on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
I think it is wrong. You need to put that out of mind, not even think about it. And just, we were elected to work for the American people, mm-hmm. elected by the American people, and that needs to be our focus. You just take that out of mind and do the right thing. And then elections come when they come, and it's a healthy part of the process. But if you let an election contaminate the deal making, negotiation mm-hmm. process of legislating, then that's what breaks the system. Our system's broken, and I think we do allow politics and elections to permeate too much of the legislating that we were elected to do.
Well, and so then we have 3 minutes left, and my next question is, can you get anything done, even if it's like the most obviously everybody's in consensus, with this whole impeachment inquiry thing hanging over? I mean, everyone's worried now that nothing else will get addressed. No other issue will be, because there's a lot of problems that we would love to see addressed.
Yeah.
Regular people, regardless of how you feel about the impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, I think regardless of how you feel, I'm not really on the inside scoop on a lot of this. I'm not on the relative committees, but I will tell my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, because of the impeachment inquiry that's moving forward, that is why we have to get stuff done. We have to show people that we aren't shutting down and turning off the lights because of this disagreement. We have even more duty to get stuff done and move things forward. So a classic example of something we're working on is the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the mm-hmm. NAFTA 2.0, that the president has negotiated an agreement. I think it gets most of the way there. There are some sticking points that I think are, you know, reasonable sticking points where people are saying we'd like to see these three or four areas strengthened. So they sent a counter proposal back to the White House, and then the counter proposal. These are actually, and I've asked, I'm not on the negotiation team or anything, but I'm asking people, do you feel like these, I'm asking both Republicans and Democrats, are we just playing games, are we inching towards an agreement? And people say that they actually think both sides are negotiating in good faith and getting us closer to an agreement. And I really hope that we can get that deal done, bring it up for a vote, and pass it with bipartisan support before the end of the year, I think is important. And the impeachment inquiry only makes it more important that we show that we can get something done in a bipartisan fashion.
Are you an outlier, or do you have a lot of colleagues who feel similarly?
I mean, there are some notable exceptions on both sides of the aisle, right? Mm-hmm. People who do, this is the only thing they care about. For me, I was elected to do a job. You know, I approach my job in Congress kind of like a mayor. I want to get stuff done. I'm focused on getting stuff done. I'm not really someone who gets all worked up about the drama. And I'm not saying that the impeachment inquiry is not important. I think there are serious allegations that have been raised that need to be understood. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to prejudge my response to that. I think the process needs to be played out. It's important. But in the meantime, let's keep focused on our day jobs, people, and let's get some stuff done that we were elected to do. And I think there are a lot of people actually with that attitude. Like I said, notable exceptions on both sides of the aisle, but I think a lot of people are still there with their sleeves rolled up, ready to get stuff done. We come back home to our districts and people are talking about the issues that they care about. And impeachment is one of those issues, but it's not the only issue by any means. They want to see us working together to get stuff done. That's what I promised to do, and that's what I'm doing.
And so do you have a realistic timeline for this, or is this just going to be something you're just going to have to keep cracking the whip on?
Yeah, I think we're continuing working on that. The one thing, so the House, there are 435 representatives, so trying to get your 10 minutes of floor time is competitive.
Midnight on Friday night, right?
So we're working on it. I think we feel good about it, but it'll kind of depend on what else is happening on the floor and where we can squeeze it in. But all the signals are good at this point, and I do feel confident that we can get it up for approval by the full House before the end of the year.
All right. Well, thank you so much for making time. It's been great to have you back in Utah. Love following your adventures, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Voices of Reason podcast.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.